Welcome to End of an Era, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and tonight we go to part three of our End of an Era series. With 11 league titles in 18 years, 18 league titles in total, and within the eye of their storm to go along with those 11 titles won between 72, 73 and 89, 90 were four European Cups, two UEFA Cups, three FA Cups and four League Cups were also collected. So just how did Liverpool's greatest era of success come to an end?
Listen to the cry now. It's spread like wildfire around Anfield. Still no sign of emotion. Well, Liverpool have done their part. They have won. And they wait now for news of the final score. Ronnie Moran wants to know what's happened. Because if Villa have drawn at home to Norwich City, the uncertainty is over. They cracked the resistance of Queen's Park Rangers and the rest of the First Division.
And the news from Villa is that they have drawn. Liverpool are the champions.
And before we meet our special guest for this discussion, first of all, it'll be no surprise that Mr. Stephen Scragg is on board with this one. Stephen, I want to say looking forward to it. Obviously, it's a part of the club's history. It's you can't have it always.
Indeed, this should be a degree of self-help. Well, therapy. I mean, now that we've won the title again, then that kind of like it's off the back a bit now. So you know, you can look back in a bit more, I don't know, slightly more relaxed manner than might have been the case 12 months ago.
You're going to feel more comfortable doing it this time now, are you?
Yeah, but I mean, it's
one of those. Oh, are you sure?
yeah, vaguely. And this was one when we mooted doing this series was one that had to be done, and our guest tonight had to be the guest for them.
It is. It absolutely is. And obviously, before I want to say reveal, I don't know why I do this. I make it into a big thing, and the name of the guest is on it before people have even clicked on it.
Do you know what? I thought that the other day. When we were doing Gary's book, I thought that this is brilliant the way we do this. And I thought, by the time anyone listens, it's there for all to see.
I know, and yet I still do it. I'm not gonna lie, I've thought about this on and off for 18 months, and yet I still do it. So
still need to do it.
I'm still not gonna reveal who it is. I'm still going to keep it a secret until we've spoken to the co-host, which obviously is Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Hi, buddy. And I think, you know, it's fine because the text that linked to the pod could just be a con anyway. So, you know, keep the guest secret because, you know, I guess one of my favourite guests, you know, he's always great value when we have him on podcasts with us. And it's a fascinating subject. And it's interesting to hear Stevie say about that this sort of discussion might be a bit of therapy. And it's interesting perhaps to reflect on, if we were having this conversation 12 months earlier than we are now, perhaps the conversation might be slightly different. But you know, we're going to talk about the end of an era of a club that was probably the most dominant club in a certainly concentrated era in English football in my living memory. And that by God, that goes back to the early 60s. So this can be a fascinating discussion.
It is, and it's something we'll get into, Gary. But I mean, obviously, Stephen will go along with this as well. But when you're a kid and you're sort of introduced to football, there's always a dominant side usually the dominant side at that time when football sort of comes into your conscience. But obviously with this side, from sort of the moment I sort of started getting into football, it literally did seem like it was going to be forever, this one. You know, I would have been, oh, the quick maths, 18 before this sort of domination finished. So, you know, sort of nearly for the, certainly for as long as I'd been into football as a child, it was always all about this side. And it was, which I suppose is what makes it even stranger as time went on. But I'm sure it's stuff we'll get into as we go along. But now to the big reveal, obviously. Now we no longer need to keep it a secret. Tonight's guest is the wonderful author, Mr. Jeff Golding. Jeff, welcome.
Surprise.
I was kidding, yeah.
Who would have guys. Who lovely would have to be on again. Absolutely lovely to be on.
I like, as Gary said, you know, I could only echo that. It's, you know, great value. It was great to have you on. You know, great stories, incredibly articulate, and obviously, you know, Stephen loves having you on. I'll be there for Gary as a little shoulder to cry on when it gets a bit, when we talk about too much success. But obviously, you know, tonight is not necessarily about the success as such. It's about, you know, it's about the decline. So to kick us off then, Jeff, I suppose we should, you know, we need to go back and just look at that, you know, that concentrated period of dominance that led up to, I suppose, this almost catastrophic, unforeseen title winning hiatus that Liverpool sort of embarked on from 90 onwards.
Yeah, so for me, I was born into that. So, you know, I consider myself incredibly privileged. I was born in, I've said this before, born the back end of the 1960s. So I missed the kind of emergence and the genesis of Liverpool as a force in English football. But I was kind of born into it, so I took it hugely for granted, really. I grew up as a kid thinking that, you know, Anfield was this mystical place and the players were nothing short of magicians. And they just continued to prove me right all the way through my childhood and my youth. And a lot of Liverpool fans of my generation say this, and I'm sure Stephen will back me up on this, but we became a little bit spoiled, I think. And you know, there were many times in the kind of mid-80s and the late 80s where you'd go the game fully expecting Liverpool to win. And if they lost, there was no anger. There was just shock and surprise. And I remember commenting to a lad next to me on the cop sometime in the 80s and saying, and I feel ashamed to say this. In fact, I'm almost hesitant to say it, but I actually said to him, this is boring. It's too easy. And that was what it was like growing up as a Liverpool supporter in that period, much as I imagine United fans will have felt throughout their period of dominance. And so, you know, I suppose the only thing I would say about the decline is that it never to me felt like a sudden fall off the edge of a cliff, which of course it was with hindsight. It was more kind of every year you thought, well, that was a bad year, but we'll do it again next year, or, you know, we'll get back next year, a couple of more signings and we'll be okay. And it was a little bit like the proverbial frog in a pan of boiling water. You know, you don't notice things happening around you. And before you know it, 10 years has gone by and we're now in an era without, you know, the league title. So for me, it kind of, there was no kind of sense of we'd suddenly fallen off the edge of a cliff. That perception sort of won I have with hindsight now. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, the period that went before and having lived through it has made it much harder to bear.
It's, I mean, you know, Stephen, is that, you know, sort of something you recognise? And I know, you know, we talked about this the other, I think it was when we looked at the Arsenal Invincible ones, bizarrely, you know, we talked about continuity at a club. And I guess, you know, with Liverpool at that time, it wasn't as though there'd been that sort of godfather figure that had looked after the club, as in Ferguson or Wenger. It was, you know, it was a passing of the baton, and, you know, from Shankly to Paisley to Fagan, albeit for a season, and on to Dalglish. Although it was, you know, there were sort of four really successful, almost seamless changes in sort of the manager at that time, and it because it seems so seamless, I think that's where, or to me, it's why Liverpool's dominance seemed almost imperious, like it could never end, because even with a change of manager, it, nobody batted an eyelid. It just, to me, you know, obviously I'm not a Liverpool fan and wasn't at Anfield, but to me it just seemed relentless, because it didn't matter that the managers were changed, the results, the game performances were still the same.
Yeah, it was. There was something empirical about it. It's a very, you know, saying it as a Liverpool fan, you know, I always hesitate, but trying as a football fan in general, and a writer of football, and analyse it and think, well, actually, you have to be honest about it at both ends of the spectrum, and that's the good and the bad. So, you know, for Liverpool, it's very unique. You know, no other club managed to do what Liverpool did in that respect, in that passing of the baton, as you say, from going from one coach to the next, and there being this line of progression, and continuity was the word. And John Smith, the chairman, used to use it. And it was all about the continuity and the handing over of this, you know, baton as the manager, and things continuing as they were. And looking through English football and the history of it, I can't see a like for like anywhere. You know, we can point to the parallels between Liverpool and Manchester United, and periods of domination. And, you know, they had Busby, we had Shankly, you know, we had Dalglish, along came Ferguson. But Manchester United have had 20 league titles, and they've only been won by three different men. You know, Manchester United are a club that thrive on a dominant, omnipresent god at the club. You know, whereas Liverpool have always had this, yes, we had Shankly, who was larger than life, but then along came Paisley, completely different personality, but someone who still ruled and ruled convincingly. Joe Fagan was, again, another character who was probably somewhere between Shankly and Paisley. And then along came Dalglish to take over. You know, it broke from that coaching continuity, but it was still a handing over to the next generation. And that continued all the way up to Roy Evans. You know, yes, we brought Graeme Souness back to the club. You know, he'd not been there for, 7 years when he took over. So there was that. But then, you know, I cannot summon up another club that did this. You know, I don't remember. You know, Arsenal didn't do it. You know, if you look at Arsenal's successes, it's Herbert Chapman. You know, they had successes in the 1950s. Then it was Bertie Mee. Then it was George Graham. Then it was Arsene Wenger. But there were perceived steps between them. There were gaps between each of those successes. So, again, you can't really compare the two. So, for Liverpool to have this very unique situation where it was passed from one to the other, and Jeff is perfectly correct in that you became blasé about it, you know, the success, and that it was every year. And those years that the title wasn't won, it was merely just a hiccup, and we've loaned it out to someone else and we will reclaim it 12 months later. You know, within that 18-year span that was mentioned at the start of this podcast, there is never any more than a two-year gap. You know, the 24 months between Liverpool winning one title and the next. You know, during that period of time, Liverpool only finish outside the top two once. And in that season that they finish outside the top two, they win the European Cup and the League Cup. This was an incredible, incredible hegemony. And it was a monopoly, but it was a competitive monopoly as well. Because within that period, Liverpool kind of like duelled it out with Don Reeves, Leeds United, Brian Clough's Derby County, his Nottingham Forest. There was the rise of Aston Villa, Ron Saunders' Aston Villa. There was Howard Kendall at Everton. Then there was George Graham at Arsenal. There was always someone running alongside that Liverpool as well, which, you know, made it a fascinating era. I think that's why people loved football at the time as well, is that, yes, there was this Liverpool, but there was also always someone that was rising to punch against them. And then within that, you know, you still threw in, you know, Manchester United unable to challenge for the title or to obtain the title. They had a few near misses, like we would have near misses over those 30 years. But you also had Tottenham as well. So they were cup specialists more than anything. But there were some big teams and big personalities and great teams, great managers, great players throughout that entire span of Liverpool's success.
I mean, you know, Gary, obviously, you and I are listening to this as non-Liverpool fans, and you know, obviously, you know, you're a passionate Chelsea fan. You know, looking at it from looking at Liverpool from afar, you know, before we started getting into the decline. But you know, as we mentioned there, those 18 years, you know, as a Chelsea fan, did you? I'm not saying did you envisage it ending? You know, they always end at some point. Empires always crumble, but. You know, to you as a Chelsea fan, did it, you know, almost, I suppose, you know, as Jeff said there, it started to get boring, or was it always the challenge of, you know, Liverpool on the benchmark, how close can we get? You know, did you use them as the barometer, if you like, for where your team were at?
Well, in the period we talked about here, Chelsea were never anywhere near Liverpool, so the short answer to that question, is not on your perishing life, mate. But I think, you know, I mean, But there's this thing that, you know, they say age gives you wisdom. I'm not sure that's true, but it certainly gives you experience. And, you know, I'm sort of old enough to remember, you know, when Tottenham won the double in the early 60s, Arsenal won the double with a dominant team. You know, if football teaches you anything, at all, it's that nothing is forever. And we're all children of our own generation. I'm old enough to remember when Liverpool were a bang ordinary second tier club before Shanks turned up and turned them into the, you know, built the foundations for the empire that became the great era that we talk about now. Just a sort of further example, you know, my daughter was born in 82. She's a Man United fan. And the people of that era, they never knew anything. They grew up knowing nothing other than Manchester United were the dominant club. And that was the way it is. And Jeff made a good point earlier when he said, you know, Liverpool fans felt a bit spoiled. And it's probably something that they, you know, fans of a dominant club don't appreciate until it's not there anymore. And you realise, this isn't the way it normally is. You know, my son was born 87, so he was sort of coming into, you know, a full appreciation of football. You know, when Chelsea were, you know, won back-to-back championships, Premier League championships. And, you know, we're all children of our generation. But I think the one thing we need to emphasise about this Liverpool team is that, you know, and Stevie mentioned this a couple of minutes ago, that this wasn't a club that had a manager that delivered like Ferguson did, like Nicholson did, like Bertie Mee and Don Howe did with Arsenal, like Mourinho did with Chelsea. This was a succession of managers that kept this domination going for a long while as the bat was passed from manager to manager. And to add into that, it wasn't just a domestic domination. They were the best team in Europe by a country mile as well, not only the best team in England. So, you know, when an empire is the right word, when the empire sort of fell apart, as all empires do eventually, the fall was massive, not from the heights of, you know, Man United won two or three European championships in, I don't know, 16, 17 years. Liverpool won three in 4 years. But the guys will correct me if I'm wrong, it's 3 or 4 years, 3 or 5 years. But, you know, the domination was far more concentrated and far greater than you know, people look of a sort of a different generation will see Manchester United being dominating English football.
To be fair, and I suppose, Jeff, you know, it's a great point that, you know, that Gary makes there. You know, it wasn't just domestic domination, it was continental domination as well. And I suppose, you know, we need to, as much as we've revelled in the glory that led up to this, I suppose we do now need to look at why we're here. So, you know, obviously they win the title, you know, and certainly as you and Stephen have just said, you know, if we don't win it the next season, it's okay because we'll get it the season after. We don't go more than 24 months, you know, before it comes back to us. So that side that won that sort of final league title then, was there any indication, you know, certainly for you who would watch them week in, week out, was there any indication at all that you were at the, not at a precipice, but certainly at a major fault line in terms of the progression of Liverpool?
I mean, I've got to be honest, if I'm, you know, thinking back to sort of my mindset in 1990, there were certainly discussions in my recollection about some of Dalglish's decision making, some of his tactics. There were certainly kind of rumblings around, but I would have been very dismissive of those, if I'm completely honest. I would have been of the mindset that, you know, as we've said before, that, you know, this is just about evolving the next great Liverpool team. And you know, we might have a lean spell next season, but we'll be back again. But obviously, that's kind of when you're in the heat of it. That's when you're in the thick of it. With hindsight, there were certainly, you know, signs there. If only we'd have paid attention, if only we'd have, you know, not been so blindsided by the unparalleled success that had gone before. You know, we had, you know, a lot of aging players in 1990, didn't we? You know, Rush, you know, Alan Hansen. There was a great quote in that wonderful BBC documentary the other night. There was a great quote from George Sefton, who's the match announcer, stadium announcer at Anfield. He said he watched Alan Hansen as the team was celebrating lifting the league title in 1990 and noticed how physically uncomfortable he was because he couldn't get down on his knee because his knees were shot at that point and his knees were gone. And, you know, there were certainly problems in terms of the squad. The squad needed to be rebuilt. And also, I mean, I'm sure we'll get onto this in due course, but there were clearly things lurking in the background, more fundamental issues going on at the club that we, you know, I don't believe any of us saw it coming, to be honest with you. And before this, you know, Steve and I have had a brief conversation and, you know, certainly the case that the media didn't see any of this coming. So it's just really interesting, really, how, you know, this edifice was crumbling in the background, but none of us could really see it coming. But you know, with hindsight, the signs of that were there.
Is it? I mean, I suppose an interesting question here then, Stephen, is obviously, you know, Liverpool are, you know, as Jeff said there, Liverpool are with this aging squad, clearly still incredibly talented footballers. Is it, you know, was it a case of, I don't know how to word this, so you have to bear with me while I try and work this question out in my head, but was that a combination of, although they were aging, they were still just that good, or was it that, you know, we talked about George Graham's Arsenal, was it that the others maybe hadn't got themselves organised enough to challenge earlier? I know, you know, Arsenal take that title at, you know, Anfield in that sort of title decider, but in terms of, you know, you talk about the sort of periods where you have a side that are looking to challenge on a regular and consistent basis, you know, that this sort of last league title, perhaps, is that more to do with, and you could look at it from Ferguson's last Premier League win as well, you know, not a great Manchester United side, but good enough because the challenges weren't up to it. So, you know, as Jeff mentioned there, I think I kind of get the point I'm getting to, you know, Jeff mentioned there that it was sort of crumbling behind the scenes that maybe as fans you weren't aware of, but was that also partially hidden by the challenge hadn't been sort of formulated by anybody else?
That last title for me felt almost like it was won on autopilot. It was won by memory. You know, there's so many players who've been there and done it before, and they just walk that walk again. You know, and that season, Arsenal struggled as defending champions. They struggled to get the head around being defending champions, and they faded around about the March or so. And they always seemed to be, you know, half a step behind, certainly from the autumn. I think they had a brightish start and then fell away a bit. They also had, was that not the year that they had a big bust up? Was that the following season? But whatever it was anyway, they never really kind of, I don't think they built on that initially. And it's always hard to have an impressive season, a big success, and then say, right, what we will do now is strengthen, or we will make a few alterations. It's a very difficult thing to do, to alter a very good and successful side. It's a brave thing to do. And it wasn't until the summer of 1990 that Arsenal implemented those changes that possibly should have happened in 89. So by 1990, they bring in David Seaman and Anders Limpar. Certain alterations are made and they kick on again. So, yeah, Arsenal fell away. Aston Villa, you know, were a surprising challenger because they'd only narrowly avoided relegation 88-89. They'd been relegated 87. Graham Taylor took over in the summer of 87, brought them straight back up. They had a bright start that first season back up, but then nosedived. And it was the poor form of others kind of kept them up. And then 89, 90, their challenge just came out of nowhere. And they were a decent side. They had Gordon Cowans in the midfield. They had the emergence of David Platt, who would make such an impression at the 1990 World Cup. They had the kind of Tony Daly, who was one of those wingers who was incredibly skillful, but a little bit too fast-paced. He would sometimes be that half a pace ahead of himself. So he would sometimes run into blind alleys. He was a wonderfully gifted player that would just play at 5-10 miles per hour too fast, but he would still rip teams apart. So they had this talented but balanced side that was very heavily based on his Watford team. So although they came out of nowhere, it retrospectively isn't as much as a surprise. But beyond that, yeah, Manchester United were still a bit of a basket case. They looked like they were on the brink of a relegation battle for quite some time. It was that FA Cup run, you know, infamously the Mark Robins goal that supposedly kept Ferguson in his job in the FA Cup. Although Martin Edwards has been on record many times saying that, you know, that wouldn't have been the case if they lost that, then he wouldn't have sacked Ferguson, which is easy to say in retrospect. Had it happened, who knows? But yeah, the challenge, you know, kind of petered out for a lot of teams. Everton, you know, they spent a lot of money, but they couldn't get the right cohesion together. So yeah, a certain amount of teams fell away. But yes, this Aston Villa side, they kept pace. They didn't just keep pace with us. They were actually a step or so ahead of us up until around about March, beginning of April, I'd say. But yes, this title was kind of won on reputation almost. You know, this was a Liverpool side that had been there, done it, and our chief challenger, you know, hadn't, basically. You know, Gordon Cowans was the only remnant from the 80-81 title-winning side that was there, and he'd been away and come back. So yes, you know, we had all the experience and everything going in our favour to do it. And, you know, Barnes was magnificent in that season. You know, John Barnes was utterly, utterly mesmeric. But beyond that, you know, there was a lot of players who missed huge chunks of the season. And these injuries, like Jeff said, were beginning to creep in. You know, if you look at the stats for that season, you'll find that, you know, you'll be surprised how many games Steve Nichol missed. You'll be very, you know, you'll be surprised how many games Ray Houghton missed. You know, Ronnie Whelan picked up a serious injury towards the end of the season. There were all sorts of issues in them Alan Hansen's as well. So yeah, there was a little bit of a retrospective creaking going on, and there was as well, you know, very much a worry about Liverpool, the defence early. You know, they've been undone massively by Crystal Palace in the FA Cup semi-final. And there was this question mark over Liverpool's aerial defensive abilities.
I mean, to be fair, any Manchester United fans that we might have encouraged with the title of this may well have switched off when you said that United was still a basket case. But that's all right. I'm sure they've enjoyed the first. I'm sure they've enjoyed the first sort of 20 minutes of this up until then. Gary, you know, for you, you know, we've sort of, you know, there we've sort of chatted about, you know, the creaking almost, the unseen creaking that, you know, maybe some of the Liverpool fans weren't aware of, or, you know, had been sort of hidden within the club. And again, I know it's a difficult question that I'm going to ask you, and hindsight's great and all those sorts of things, but do you think almost that the title win of 90 almost didn't do them any favours? You know, had they not have won, would the repair that would have got underway slightly earlier, would it not have been quite such a long sort of drawn out process? Or do you think, you know, that final title win actually did a lot of damage retrospectively?
Yeah, strange enough, I think that's not a bad assessment, Stu. And it's interesting to hear Stevie say that he thought the title was won on autopilot. And I know what it means. You know, just on a contemporary sort of comparison, Real Madrid won this title in the Liga title this year, not because they were the best team, but because Barcelona fell away. And, you know, they were sort of riven by internal disputes. And you know, Real Madrid, their top scorer was Benzema, a striker. The second top scorer was their centre-half, Sergio Ramos. That doesn't suggest they're the best team in the league. You know, their top signing, Eden Hazard, scored one goal all season. So, you know, you can win a league title without being the best team. No, sorry, you're always the best team by definition, but without sort of being at your very best. And I think Liverpool were sort of over the crest of the wave of their success and were on the downward spiral. But it hadn't been recognised because, as Stevie quite rightly mentions, the opposition players had fallen away. And Liverpool had, when they were at their dominant best, they had this great ability. You know, the question is, when do you strengthen your team? And the question is, all the time. You know, when you're winning, you strengthen your team. When you lose, you strengthen your team. And Liverpool had this gift of, I don't know if gift's not the right word, but that ability, that knowledge to understand the importance of strengthening the team each year. And they would sign players and keep the momentum going. And much as, you know, the bat was handed on with managers and coaches, so it was in the team as well. And the responsibility for scoring goals, for being the dominant guy in the defence, to being the midfield dynamo, that was passed on also at the same time. And so at this sort of period we're talking now, that sort of fell away. There was a lot of, well, you know, but you can look back and say, okay, hindsight's a great thing. The signing of David Speedy, for example, the signing of Jimmy Carter, for example, these weren't the players that would have fitted into the Liverpool team in their heyday, not by a country mile. And, you know, I'm not sure whether it's a symptom or it's a result of the decline, but it's certainly one of the two.
You know, if we sort of get into, you know, this, you know, chat about decline, Jeff, you know, and it's sort of clear, and, you know, as Gary said, hindsight's a great thing, and it sort of becomes clear and obvious now, and history sort of tells us that it was. But in terms of leading up to there, you have the, you know, the buying back of Ian Rush, and, you know, they say never go back to a club, or, you know, never go back, but there's that sort of decision, which I'm not saying seemed very un-Liverpool like. Again, you and Stephen will know far better than me, but it seemed a strange decision to sort of bring him back. And then you also have Hansen, you know, who you mentioned there, you know, by 1990 his knees are gone, but he was sort of 34, I think 35 at that point. So Lawrence leaves sort of, you know, 2 years earlier. Hansen is already 32, 33. So there's clearly an issue at the, you know, at centre half, and yet you have the re-signing of Ian Rush. And do you think, as Gary's mentioned, they started to get the transfer policy wrong, or took their eye off the ball as to where change was needed?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Again, though, I'd have to say that that's something I kind of feel with hindsight. I remember being my only concern at the time about re-signing Ian Rush was what impact that was going to have on John Aldridge, who I absolutely loved, who was a great goal scorer for Liverpool. So kind of as a kid, in the midst of all that, you know, I was absolutely delighted to see Rushy back. Well, obviously with hindsight, you can, Liverpool in their entire history, I think, might have re-signed a player once or twice he'd left. And so it was very un-Liverpool-like. Although he'd been an absolutely incredible player up until he left for Juve, and we paid, you know, a big amount of money at the time to get him back as well. It was about £3 million, I think. Steve might correct me on that, but I think it was around £3.5 million.
Yeah, just under £3 million. I think we made something it was something daft, like we made £500,000 profits on him. I think he went for like 3.2 and he came back for like 2.7 right. or so, or something like that.
Maybe in that context, it's not bad business, but that money could have, as you kind of allude to, Stu, that money potentially could have been used to improve the squad elsewhere. And, you know, undoubtedly there were decisions made in terms of the transfer market kind of as we moved towards the end of the 80s that were questionable. But I think that's one of the problems with a club that's sort of been dominant for so long and has got so much right over so such a long period of time, you know, you kind of weigh any decisions that you're a little bit dubious about against their previous track record, and you think, well, you know, maybe they know something we don't. But absolutely, you know, I think the sort of decision making, not only in terms of signing players, but the decision making of the club generally, you know, with hindsight, is a factor that may, you know, Gary says, is it a symptom or is it a cause? I think probably on balance, it's a symptom of a deeper malaise that was just beginning to sort of show itself. But was certainly a factor that contributed to us eventually collapsing at the end of the decade.
It's a point, and to be fair, either, you know, yourself, Jeff, or Stephen, you can answer this. But I'm interested to know, and it's not something we'd sort of thought about mentioning, but just sort of sat here in terms of players coming through, young players coming through. You know, I guess behind the scenes they would have known. Obviously, there's no hiding the age of Alan Hansen. There's, you know, and this is an aging squad. But in terms of either youth development or development from the younger players, was there an issue or a, not an issue? Was there a problem there with young players not coming through, or was it again just this victim of circumstance, this almost perfect storm whereby, you know, you had an aging squad, but you just happened to have a crop of youngsters that just weren't up to it. I suppose I'm just interested in what was being produced at that time through the academy system or through the youth team that maybe could have helped, you know, that could have maybe been brought through and played alongside Hansen or whatever it is, just to gain that little bit of experience had they have seen these problems slightly earlier.
I'd say that, you know, we had this was before the academy system. So what you had at the time was your first team, your reserve side. For us, it was the Central League that they were playing. And unlike now where it's the under 21s and it's predominantly younger players, this was a, you know, mixed age group that would play, you know, below the first team in their own regionalised league, reserve league. And it would be a mixture of players who were up and coming youngsters, you know, old pros on the way out, first team players who were working their way back from injury. And in a way, it was a great breeding ground for players who were trying to make the breakthrough, because they were getting to play alongside, you know, star names from time to time. And sometimes, you know, players would just turn out just for the sake of having a game. You know, Bruce Grobler was a great one for that. You know, you look at the stats and find he played half a dozen reserve games just because he was bored on a Tuesday night and fancied a game, so he'd go and play with the reserves or something like that. But Liverpool won the reserve title in that last season that Liverpool won the league as well, and it was a strong reserve side. But I think they were seen as a set of players that, apart from Steve McManaman, who did come thundering through, they were largely seen as a set of players that were good, but not quite good enough for Liverpool. So it was like the likes of Nick Tanner, who would get games in time to come, but in an injury crisis, you know, in any other circumstances, he wouldn't have played the number of games that he did. We had Alex Watson, who was Dave Watson's younger brother, who I always rated. I thought he was a decent central defender, but he lacked a bit of pace. You know, his positional sense was great, but he just lacked the pace to make that step up. We had Mike Marsh, who did make, you know, the breakthrough and play games, but there was always ambiguity over where he should play. He was a striker for the reserves, but he played quite a lot of football. Most of his football as a Liverpool first team player under Graeme Souness would be in the centre of midfield, even at right back at times. That famous night against Auxerre, for instance, in the UEFA Cup, he was playing at right back when Rob Jones was unavailable for those games because he'd been signed partway through the season. So yes, we had Jim Magilton, sorry, was another one. He was a Northern Ireland international before he made a league appearance. You know, he ended up going out and having a decent career around with Ipswich and I think Southampton as well, but he was just seen as not being quite good enough to be a Liverpool first team player. So, you know, Liverpool would do this, and throughout the 80s, there were very few who made it through from the reserves and made a lasting impact. Gary Ablett was one, although he was often the odd man out at times. Prior to that, it was Sammy Lee. You would have these players who would threaten the first team, but then fall away. You know, Mark Seagraves was another, you know, showed some promise, made a couple of appearances in the Cups in 85-86, inclusive of a League Cup semi-final. Never made a league appearance for us and then fell away, but had a strong career, played you know, a lot of years at Bolton Wanderers. So, yeah, I think they were just seen as being, you know, good players when what they were looking for was great players for the first team. So they still had that mindset that you had to be just that cut above to be able to make it into the Liverpool first team. So it was very difficult at the time to make it through from the reserves as a Liverpool player.
I mean, thank you for that. I appreciate the clearing up of it because, like I say, it was something that I was, that I've been sat here pondering to myself while listening to you. And it. And but it does actually bring another point that I was going to ask Gary, actually, and that it seems strange, and I'll ask Jeff in a second about, you know, sort of before Dalglish, just before Dalglish leaves, and not the state he leaves the club in, because that's clearly the wrong way to have it, but it, in terms of the business that Dalglish does before he leaves, you know, I'll speak to Jeff about that before. But Gary, you would assume that, you know, Liverpool, you know, we go back to this period of dominance, the reigning league champions, you would like to think that these players, as Stephen said there, that were a cut above, would be queuing up to come to Liverpool. You would think it would be easy at that time, at the end of that season, to attract the very best players to the reigning league champions. I know we have the, you know, we have the fallout from Heysland, that, you know, and the ban from European football slightly skews where the very, very best players want to go in order to still be able to play in European competition. But, you know, there should still have been enough draw and pull there for the very best players still to want to come to Liverpool.
I mean, I think there's two elements to this, to where we are with this. And, you know, I want to just sort of pick up what Steve said earlier about, you know, the young players coming through and, you know, why there wasn't so much, so many young players coming through. And it's, you know, if you think about it, it's probably self-explanatory when you sort of say that, you know, the higher the level of the club's success, the more difficult it is for a player to come through the ranks and be successful because the bar is so much higher. You know, and you know, if you're a, you know, a club in the second division or second, should we say second tier, is called the Championship, isn't it now, nowadays, and new money. You know, you've got more chance of coming through through those sorts of levels than you have if you're the top club in the country. Just for an example, David Platt couldn't make it through at Manchester United, had to go down to Crewe to get his chance and then come through from there. So I think it's, you know, it's almost like a self-defining prophecy that the higher the standard of the first team, the more difficult it is for players to get through. So that's the first. And the second thing, you know, to answer your question, you say about why couldn't Liverpool attract the players that they had before? I'm sure they could attract some of the players, but the Heysel ban was a massive thing. European club football at this stage was becoming a preeminent thing in a footballer's career. And, you know, players wanted to compete at the highest level because that's just human nature. Whatever field of enterprise you're in, you want to compete at the highest level. You want to test yourself. You want to prove yourself. And Liverpool's absence from European competition massively hurt their recruitment policy and ability to draw the best players to the club that they had attracted previously. And I think that, you know, is certainly a contributing factor in the decline of the of Liverpool after Heysel.
I mean, I would throw in that that was summer of 88 was very pivotal to Liverpool, is that you've got to look at the strength of that 87-88 side that Liverpool had. They had a very kind of like futuristic kind of strength to that squad. If you look at kind of like the cup final side that played against Wimbledon, it was Grablar, it was Hansen, Gillespie, Nicol, Ablett, McMahon, Spackman, Howson, Barnes, Beardsley, Aldridge. And on the bench, there was Craig Johnson, Jan Mulby, Whelan, missed out. And then there were other players as well that had been there but had fallen away either through injury or moved on because they wanted to play. You know, Paul Walsh started the season as a Liverpool player. John Walk did. You know, Mark Lawrenson did. You know, his Achilles went and it killed his career off in the January. You know, there were an absolute Barry Venison was another one. the names, there was a good, strong 20-man squad almost. And then you had, those knocking on the fringes. We also had someone by the name of Wayne Harrison, who was, expected to be, the next big thing, and had a succession of bizarre and tragic injuries, and eventually lost his life after his playing days. Epically doomed, personality. And this strength of squad just kind of eroded. It chipped away, bit by bit. And, the summer of 88, when Ian Rush comes back, that was on the day that he was unveiled at a press conference. The assembled press corps and a lot of people across Merseyside had fully expected that Liverpool were announcing the signing of Gary Pallister. So part of that kind of sense of hindsight with that, where Liverpool needed to spend the money at the time, some of it was clear sight. There was a feeling that a defender was needed because the loss of Lawrence, and people were looking at the age of Hansen, and previous Liverpools had kind of had the next plan already under wraps before the old guard were moved on, and this was where it kind of stopped, on the basis of what was a vanity signing almost in bringing Ian Rush back. Rush was brought back kind of to stop other first division teams getting hold of him. He wanted to come back to English football. I think he'd have been better staying in Italy, for a variety of Liverpool's reasons, but it wasn't to be. And I think it was a case of, once his interest was piqued in returning, that Liverpool moved to stop him going anywhere else. They didn't need him. And for a like for like, in a way, was when Kevin Keegan became available in 1980, and he decided to return home in preparation for the 82 World Cup. Liverpool had first refusal on Keegan, and they passed on him, because they felt that, as good as he was, they just didn't need him. And that was where Liverpool were in 88. They didn't need Ian Rush in 88, but just somewhere that sense of fear, I think, and him falling into the wrong hands was what propelled, it pushed Liverpool to make this sign. And what was needed was a central defender. And, there's also a story that goes that Dalglish would wanted to sign Paul Gascoigne from Newcastle United, and that a deal was semi-set up. But then when Rush became available, he asked Gascoigne to hang on for a year, and he was unwilling to do so and moved to Tottenham instead.
That's great. These are sort of fascinating, to get the detail behind this. And it's...
If I'm just jumping for a second, Stuart. It's also worth mentioning that Liverpool have a massively impressive history of picking up players from lower division clubs. Keegan's a great example, Ray Clements, and I think Alec Lindsay. I think they had Lindsay the sign from Bury.
Yeah, there was loads. Like Phil Neal from Northampton Town. There was loads.
Neal's a great club as well.
What I would throw into the mix, sorry, just to go back to the previous point there, but and then you go for it, Gary, then. In the summer of 88 was a huge one across the first division, was that there was a television contract signed with ITV, and it was the biggest windfall that clubs had. So many clubs were armed with a lot of money in the summer of 1988. Everton signed like Tony Cotty for £2 million. A lot of clubs made big, big signings. If you look back to that summer of 88, that's where Manchester United bring back Mark Hughes. That is where Everton signed Tony Cotty. That's where Tottenham get hold of Paul, not just Paul Gascoigne, but Paul Stewart as well. The teams were spending, the big five, the fabled big five at the time, they were spending massive amounts of money.
Yeah. Steve, who worked together far too long, buddy, because you just took the words right out of my mouth. And, I'm just saying that sort of ability to pick up players from lower division clubs was sort of destroyed by money coming to football, but with the TV contracts. But you've sort of nailed it there, buddy.
As we take this forward, Jeff, I'm quite we've sort of looked at what the domestic scene looked like in terms of transfer policy, who was available, who wasn't, what Liverpool's preferred policy was. But obviously Dalglish goes in the February of 91, and I suppose I'm after, a, I suppose, a sense of not the state you left Liverpool in. They were, you know, reigning champions. But in terms of, you know, it was such a shock when he went. But, you know, did he leave the club almost, you know, not only is it, you know, a jarring piece of news that he sort of, that he's stepping down, but has he also stepped down with the club probably not in the best of health? Would it have been better if he'd stayed to the end of the season, or if he'd given more notice that he was intending to leave?
I think there's a number of things you have to say about that. And I mean, objectively, the team were, you know, in another title race, still in the FA Cup, I think. It was that 4-4 against Everton.
Yeah,
well, it was the thing that seems to have precipitated things. I think you can't discuss that. I think undoubtedly it's true that when Dalglish left, the club was probably in a worse state than it had been in a long time. In terms of the squad, in terms of the way it was operating at a business level, the way it was operating behind the scenes. But I don't think you can really discuss that in the context of a single man. I think this was the product of 4 or 5 years, really, of things that were going on behind the scenes of the club that were coming to fruition. So Gary's mentioned Heisel, the ban. I think that had a huge... And then, of course, just a few years later, he's involved in yet another stadium disaster. So I think, you know, I think those things had a huge impact both on the club, on the city, and on the coaching staff. But I think on top of that as well, and it's this kind of thing that I always sort of think about when I look back on that period, is Liverpool do have all of the features. You know, if you look at the collapse of any empire, be it a kind of geopolitical empire or a sporting empire or a business empire, they all have those same features. They have the kind of running out of ideas, running out of the ability to innovate. They have sort of internal catastrophes of some kind or other, which destabilise the organisation or the institution or the empire itself. And so you had that going on. You also had kind of this, we touched on right at the very beginning, we touched on the kind of boot room, the dynasty almost, the seamless handing over from one manager to another, 4 managers continuing that unparalleled success. But Liverpool kind of almost ran out of those people at the club. So Fagan had gone. He'd gone in after Heisel. He had announced he was going to go at the start of the season. Paisley now was no longer influential behind the scenes in the club. At the start of Dalglish's reign, Paisley was sort of a mentor for Dalglish. You had people like the chief scout, Jeff Twentyman. You had him leaving the club in 86. Ronnie Moran, you know, very influential behind the scenes as a coach, but not really interested in stepping up and being manager. And you kind of sort of ran out of these really powerful figures in the background of the club. And you had that combined with, you know, 2 major disasters. You know, the impact of that on the health of the people at the top of the club. And then also a kind of almost a running out of ideas at the top of the club as well, coupled with, you know, the rest of the league starting to get its act together. And I'm sure that as Gary has hinted at, that the kind of the loss of European football will have made Liverpool a less attractive option. It's also worth bearing in mind that Liverpool at the time, I remember, were reputedly in for Charlie Nicholas, who ended up going to Arsenal as well. And I think there is probably something in the fact that Liverpool's luster was starting to fade a little bit, and it might be a bit of a reach, but also you've got to think about Liverpool as a city throughout the 60s and 70s. Liverpool as a city was seen as a thriving, you know, great place to be, but there were signs of social decline, the fabric of the city as well throughout the 80s. And so for me, I think, you know, it's absolutely right to say that when Dalglish left, Liverpool lacked the ability, they lacked the resilience and the ability to go again. But I think that was not the product of one man and his decision. I think that was the product of probably 5 years or a little bit more of things starting to unravel at the club. and then sort of gaining momentum towards the end of the decade for all the reasons that, that Stephen's alluded to as well. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of my sense of
what has happened. Absolutely. I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. It's, you know, one man can never take, you know, responsibility. And I think, and again, just touch on this, I don't think anyone can know the, not the internal damage, but the damage that must have been done by Heysel and Hillsborough to Kenny Dalglish. And, but also, I'm not a Liverpool fan, but, you know, sort of the admiration that I have for him and the way he conducted himself, certainly through the Hillsborough tragedy. And, you know, what he did, for me, he can do no wrong. You know, Liverpool isn't my club. So, you know, I can't speak from a Liverpool fan's perspective, but for me, he's almost bulletproof in terms of what he did for Liverpool Football Club, not only as a player and as a manager in terms of winning trophies, but for the way he handled himself through Hillsborough and was sort of the ambassador in the face for the club at that time. I can't even begin to imagine the toll it must have taken on him.
I almost wonder, you know how the Liverpool hierarchy, you know, in the aftermath of that, you know, seemed unable to sort of identify those issues. You know, not only the impact on Dalglish, but the impact on the players, the coaching staff who will have attended many of the funerals, visited people in the hospitals, and so on. And almost what's always interested me really is that Dalglish resigns, and in his press conference, he's clearly a broken man. He's actually crying. You can actually see him crying in the press conference. And then he goes away and goes to the States, and he comes back and he takes over at Blackburn and goes on to win the title at Blackburn. And you almost wonder, you know, could the club not have wrapped its arms around him at that point and maybe given him a break, or maybe put someone else in, you know, alongside him for a period or something? You know, I just feel like the club just clearly takes its eye off the ball in a big way in the last 5 years of the 1980s. And I think just so many things going wrong behind the scenes, and all of this is with hindsight. With hindsight, it almost seems inevitable.
I think you look at the game today, and it's, you know, mental health is very much, you know, at the forefront. Players' welfare, you know, players' welfare is very much first and foremost. Managerial welfare is very much first and foremost. And not only, you know, it was such an unprecedented event. Yes, there's Heysel that comes before it, but the Hillsborough tragedy is so unprecedented. And like you say, I'm not saying the club could have done best to look after, the club needed to look after itself as a, you know, as an entire entity. I appreciate this is slightly off topic, but it, you know, with regards to you, Stephen, I mean, again, I'm not saying that, you know, how much of a part does Hillsborough play in this, but I don't think it can be ignored, you know, the fragility, if you like, of Dalglish and probably some of the players as well, as Jeff said there, the immense trauma that anybody who was associated with the club went through at that time must have had an impact on this, and not only impacted at the time, but also its ability to regenerate and rebuild and recenter. That also must have been hampered by what went on previously.
Oh, of course. I mean, it completely alters your sense of perspective, you know, when something like that happens. So previously, when you turn around, the be-all and the end-all is winning that league title and you know, or winning that European Cup, and you know, for Heysel to happen, you know, was bad enough. And then along came Hillsborough, and you know, so many people, you know, still walk with that and live with that to this day. You know, fascinating documentary on the BBC a couple of nights ago. You know, you can see how Alan Hansen still talks about it now, and you know, he talks about the supporters on the pitch, and he still remembers the words that were said to him about, you know, people dying in those pens. And you know, you can see the years just drop off him in his eyes, that he's there as he's saying this, and you can never take that away. You know, it's there and it lives with people. So yes, that sense of perspective alters dramatically, you know, for the whole club, for the manager, for the players who were there that day. And, you know, yes, new signs come along, but suddenly the aura, but the soul of the club has changed somewhat. It's altered, and it'll never quite be the same again. So within that, you know, Liverpool's only way forward from there is a continued evolution or a reinvention. And, you know, they don't do that. They kind of like freeze.
And Gary, I suppose you would move from Steven Gerrard. We're in it and living it, and it seems quite trite at the moment, to speak about football. As Steven said, it didn't become about league titles, but in terms of a sort of a one step removed from the Liverpool situation, you know, and as a Chelsea fan, you couldn't help but notice that Liverpool had changed, and of course it would change. You know, something like that would always change a club. But and Jeff mentioned there about Dalglish in the press conference, and all of these things just seem to be adding up and adding up and adding up. That it almost seems inevitable that Liverpool would eventually sort of crash and burn.
Yeah, Hillsborough is a important memory for me because I was at Hillsborough for the Wolves Tottenham semi-final a few years before the Hillsborough tragedy. And although the Wolves fans, where I was, were the other end of the stadium from the Leppings Lane end where the Tottenham fans were, it so nearly happened then. And I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, wife and I went to Liverpool. We made a point of going to the Hillsborough Memorial there. And I always hold dear Anne Williams in my heart because I think, excuse me, I'm getting a bit emotional here, but, a massive heroine for humanity. You know, I'm not saying to say for Liverpool, I'm not going to say for football fans, but for humanity. And every success that the Hillsborough Support Foundation has, I think it's a massive tribute to Anne Williams and the work she did before she passed on. So, moving on from that and to answer your question, it was another brick in that same wall that prevented Liverpool from sort of moving on. And, every empire has an end. You can look back through history, and, you can go back through almost every country in Europe, be it Britain, be it France, be it Spain, be it the Dutch, beat the Italians, the Greeks, the Russians, the Egyptians, I know that's in Europe, but I'm just sort of spending the sort of metaphor a little bit, have had a sort of poke at world domination. And, it's the same with football clubs. And there's only one thing that guarantees about an empire that's going to come to an end sometime. And if it's not for reason A, it's for reason B. If it's not for reason B, it's for reason C. But there will always be a reason why that empire will fall apart. Because, as I said earlier, if football teaches us anything, it's that nothing's forever. Nothing's forever. And, we can sort of analyse why Liverpool's empire fell apart towards the era we're talking about. But if it hadn't been for reason A, then it would have been reason B. Because the world turns, nothing's forever in football.
You're absolutely right, as always, Gary. Always the wisest man in the room. But Jeff, I'm interested because, in theory, Souness, comes with a Liverpool pedigree. He comes with not so much pedigree, but he comes through that tradition. He's someone who's been in and around the fabled boot room. It's not like he's coming into a club with no sense of heritage or tradition. But yet, he seems to go, and again, I apologise, I'm not a Liverpool fan, but he just seems to go about the job in a very non-Liverpool way. And I don't know if that's just Graham Souness's personality and that's how it seems to come across. And actually, the way he managed, the way he did his business, very Liverpool. But it just seems to come across as a very sort of jarring appointment when it really shouldn't have been.
No, absolutely. I think I would have, I was certainly... happy that we brought Souness in. I think it was Liverpool, as we've said already, always kind of reached into the boot room. They always went for continuity. Bentley goes, they bring Paisley in. Paisley goes, you know, to Fagan, then Dalglish. Dalglish was still playing at the time when he came in. And I think the success of Dalglish's appointment probably influences to some degree Liverpool's decision to go for an ex-player, and an ex-player who, you know, left the club as a legend. You know, was there in his last game for the club. You know, he's thrown his shirt into the cop and he goes off the pitch and the cop are chanting relentlessly for him to come back on the pitch, and he comes back out on the pitch. This man was adored by Liverpool fans. Was many Liverpool fans of my generation would say he's, you know, still the greatest midfielder that they've ever seen. And, you know, it's always a debate whether it's Gerrard or Graeme Souness these days. Him coming into the club was not a controversial decision as far as I was concerned. And I don't think the club will have had any qualms about it. They've done that with Dalglish, both players of a similar pedigree, both knew the game really well, both knew Liverpool inside out. And, of course, Souness had gone up to Scotland and done well up in Scotland as well. So there was I don't remember there being any huge controversy around the appointment of Graeme Souness. But I think the problem with Graeme Souness was that he had seen life outside of Liverpool, and he had seen and been influenced, you know, and understood that the game was changing, that, you know, diet and lifestyle was important. He had sort of started to think that Liverpool needed to modernise, and definitely a sense now, and I think we probably all felt it. And I remember there being, and Steve with his encyclopedic memory of these matters will be able to say better than me, but I just remember there being a horrendous succession of injuries, and whether that was players not wanting to play for Souness, or whether the training methods were you know, too rigorous, or whether the, you know, players were struggling to adjust to the new rules around lifestyle and diet. But I just remember there being lots and lots of injuries during Souness's reign. And for me, there's very much a sense of what he was trying to do was probably the right thing, and it was probably needed, but it was probably too soon for that squad. It was too soon for Liverpool Football Club, and what he was attempting to do was a revolution when we needed perhaps to evolve. Symbolically, he kind of set about demolishing the boot room, and, you know, it's his way of saying, you know, I'm putting my stamp on Liverpool Football Club. And, you know, in any big organisation or any big institution, if you're trying to implement change, you have to take the institution, you have to take the organisation with you. You have to have allies. And there's a sense for me that he became an isolated figure almost of the club, and that his methods and his ways were, you know, he hadn't won people over. He hadn't carried people with him. And for me, you know, that played a huge part in his downfall. And, you know, the results speak for themselves, don't they?
Absolutely. It's funny. I was about to ask you there as well, Stephen, in terms of, I'm not saying it's an inferiority complex. As a European Cup winning captain, you know, you can't have an inferiority complex as such. But do you think, not that he tried too hard, but that he felt that he had maybe more to prove than perhaps Dalglish had?
I think he himself has been bold enough and honest enough to admit the mistakes that he made. You know, he took to Liverpool with a sledgehammer when, you know, a toffee hammer was needed. They were still a club that, you know, could have got by on advanced evolution. You know, it still needed a subtle hand, and he went a bit bull in a china shop. You know, he himself says about how certain players came to him. You know, he spelt out his vision for the club. Certain players came to him and said that they wanted out, and as soon as they said they wanted out, he was like, "Well, right, let's get them out." And he's acknowledged since then that that was the wrong thing to do, that Liverpool's way of dealing with the departure of players was that a player was only replaced if someone coming in was better than what was there, or the longer term picture was more promising than what was there. What he had was players like Ray Houghton, eager to leave. Steve McMahon wasn't really for it. There were several players that were still there from when Souness was a player. Bruce Grobbelaar, Steve Nicol, Ronnie Whelan amongst them. And, you know, these were players that remembered Souness, the player, the captain, you know, this legend on the pitch, but also, you know, a kind of a drinking buddy. You know, he was there. He was a bigger partier than anyone else in that Liverpool squad of the late 1970s and throughout the first half of the 1980s. So for him to be returning to the club, you know, still fresh in mind for certain players, coming back preaching this new way of approaching football and diet and preparation. You know, Souness was essentially, in that respect, the right man, but at the wrong time. If maybe Liverpool had appointed Roy Evans first and then Graeme Souness rather than the other way around, it might well have been a different result with Graeme Souness as the manager of Liverpool. He did some fine things. You know, he brought in, you know, he gave youth a chance in a way that Dalglish never did. You know, Dalglish gave Steve McManaman his debut, and I think McManaman would have thrived under Dalglish, and Dalglish would have run with him. But and he also signed kind of like Jamie Redknapp. He brought in Don Hutchinson. He signed Steve Hartness. You know, Robbie Fowler was brought into the youth ranks while Dalglish was there. So, you know, he did have this eye on the future and youth being the answer. But I think that Souness was always going to be quicker at implementing those players. You know, the signing of Rob Jones was fantastic. He was a wonderful, wonderful right back. You know, he gave Hutchison and Redknapp games, and maybe it was down to those injuries that Jeff spoke of earlier. You know, if the players that were injured weren't injured quite so catastrophically as they were, then, you know, maybe they didn't get the games in the numbers that they did. But yes, there was a spate of, I seem to remember them being Achilles injuries. You know, yeah. John Barnes and Mark Wright in particular, I think they both had ruptured Achilles within the first two games of the season. And then Barnes again later in the season while on England duty. He had Phil Borsma in with him as his number two, who he'd had with him at Rangers. They'd been teammates at Middlesbrough. Borsma being an ex-Liverpool player as well, but not while Souness was there. He brought him in, and there was perceived to be a great deal of unrest about that he wasn't a popular figure. And this spate of injuries meant he picked up the unfortunate name of being Dr. Death. Yeah. As I remember, and yes, you know, this Liverpool of Souness's was you know, there was a certain set of ingredients that were wonderful and should have worked. You know, the emergence of Fowler eventually, yet it just never, fate seemed to conspire against him. You know, he made his own mistakes, but fate didn't smile him either.
I just wonder, sorry, Stu, if I can make another point. I just wonder about, and I see this in him as a pundit, actually. And I, you know, I am speculating to a large degree, but I just wonder whether there's something about that psychology of a great player, maybe is why not many truly great players go on to become great managers, certainly in the history of our game, I think, you know. And, you know, I don't know how much Souness could tolerate players being slightly less than 100%. In everything they do. And you see him as a pundit, don't you? You see him talking about players today and, you know, very unforgiving in terms of players not giving absolutely everything. And he certainly doesn't strike me. And certainly comments made by players like Robbie Fowler, Sims and others, you know, he doesn't strike me as the type of manager who can put his arm around someone and, you know, that certainly the stories he's told himself about players coming to him and saying, I don't think this is for me, and him going, right, well, you're out the door then. If you want to play for a football club, then we'll find somewhere else for you to play. And you just wonder whether another manager would have handled that differently, or Dalglish would have handled that differently.
Yeah, they would have done. I mean, Souness himself has said that, you know, he should have dealt with that better than he did.
Yeah.
You know, and when he's alluded to that, you get the idea that what he's trying to put across is that the approach is, well, fair enough, you want to go, but you'll go when we're ready. to let you go. Once we've got the people that we think should replace you, then fair enough. Whereas he ushered them to the door and brought in inferior players. You know, to lose a Steve McMahon and basically, you know, we get Paul Stewart instead. You know, there were a lot of rush signings. You know, Julian Dix, you know, never a Liverpool player.
Yeah.
Neil Ruddock, never a Liverpool player. But on occasions, you know, he did buy what should have been a Liverpool player. Nigel Clough should have fitted Liverpool perfectly, yet, you know, he didn't. You know, so this is what he had, was this, there was a combination of, you know, ill judgment, being a bit too hasty over his dealing with certain issues and players, and luck just not being on his side. Those injuries were ridiculous. You know, he lost the peak John Barnes, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, those Achilles injuries, you know, it changed John Barnes. And, you know, yes, there was a later reinvention under Roy Evans, where he became a deep sitting central midfielder of passing purpose. You know, he was great in that role. But within that, a lot of Liverpool fans couldn't take him playing that role because they just wanted the Barnes of old, who could never return. And the job that he did in that 3-5-2 formation that Roy Evans had, he did a great job in that role for a good few years. But yeah, you know, you've got to look at just how much Souness was deprived of as well. So yes, you know, he conspired against himself, but, you know, fate conspired against him as well.
Yeah,
it's, I mean, you know, again, Gary, you know, I keep coming to you as the sort of observer of this sort of crumbling of Liverpool's empire, and I suppose your opinion on Souness, A, when he was appointed, but B, as you can sort of almost, you know, again, to me, things sort of seemed to gather pace quite quickly. And, you know, it became a constant trying to catch up with you know, with yourself, and be it through injuries, through some signings not working out. Obviously, you know, some signings do work out, but it's almost like that Liverpool is beyond almost Souness's control, and the tighter he tries to cling on and tighten his grip around the club, the faster it seems to fall away.
Yeah, it is. You know, as a football fan, you must have a massive amount of sympathy for Souness and the role he sort of inherited. And, you know, Liverpool were in decline at the time, and he was the guy who was sort of charged with arresting the decline and bringing back the glory days. And it was almost an impossible task. And, you know, as I said before, you know, the one thing sure about empires that they always fall apart. And, you know, Souness was the guy who was handed the sort of the sand was running through his fingers, and he couldn't, I'm going to mix the metaphor here, he couldn't grasp the fish too tight, that he slipped through his fingers. And, you know, trying to bring in players that weren't Liverpool players, as the guys have discussed, and not being almost a Liverpool manager. You know, that sounds a little bit weird, but for people who sort of can't appreciate the era where Liverpool were dominant, you know, the Paisley era, the Shankly era, you know, even the Fagan and to some extent Roy Evans era, Souness was sort of almost like an outsider. You know, it just sounds strange for a guy who played for so many times Liverpool and won so many trophies, but to be the man who was handed the almost the hospital pass, as it were, to maintain that status was an impossible task. And, you know, it was probably no great surprise when, you know, he failed the impossible task.
It's, I mean, you know, guys, we're already at an hour and 20 minutes, but it's, which may please some Man United fans that are still listening, that we've thought for an hour and 20 minutes about the demise of Liverpool Football Club. However, we are kind of going to have to bring it sort of full circle and you know, back to sort of where Liverpool are now. And obviously you can't say, you know, I'm not going to ask you all, right, is this Liverpool back? Are we about to see another period of domination by Liverpool? Because, you know, it's, yes, you know, there's a Champions League or a European Cup, as far as I like to call it. There's a league title win, and, you know, you have to start somewhere. You know, there's got to be that first league title. But I suppose I'm interested in sort of where you see, not where you see Liverpool going from here, but, you know, is will lessons be learned from sort of 1990? Is Jurgen Klopp sort of somebody who's going to be in this for the long haul? And will he also establish sort of a pathway for, you know, future coaches to come into the club and take over? You know, you, when you look at somewhere like Manchester City, and it was perceived that Arteta would take over from Guardiola, and, you know, you had almost that going on. But do you, you know, is Klopp the sort of person who will look to reinstate, you can't replicate the boot room, but is he somebody who is looking to sort of solidify this current period of dominance that we've had over the last 2-3 seasons? And, you know, is he the right person to lay the foundations for the Liverpool 2.0, if you want to call them that? Jeff, you know, I don't know what you think to that.
In some ways, I find it a really difficult question to answer, really. So if I look back to how Liverpool developed into the dynasty that they became, I think there were certain recipes there that the modern game doesn't allow for. So when Shankly came in, there was already, you know, boot room team were there, all of the ingredients of the boot room team were there. He didn't sack anyone when he came in. He kept everyone on, and they worked as a kind of collective. They were certainly developing that at Anfield now, and he's got a very, very strong backroom team. I watched a documentary on LFC TV a number of weeks ago, which was called Coaching Champions, and it was exclusively about the team behind the team. You know, they didn't interview Klopp, they interviewed the entire backroom staff. And what was absolutely clear to me is how Klopp has constructed this hugely strong collective behind him. And so on paper, at least, all of the ingredients are there. It's just that what worries me, or what concerns me, is the modern football kind of, if you look across the board, when change happens at the top, a new broom comes in and tends to sweep all else aside and bring their own people in. And so I guess a lot of that hinges on how the ownership behave, and whether they can, you know, because Klopp has said we're all led to believe that in 2024, when his contract's up, Klopp will take another sabbatical. And so there are people in the background, the likes of Pep Linders, very, very highly, highly regarded at Liverpool. You know, whether any of those people are going to be ready to step up and take the reins when Klopp goes. Although you would have to say that modern precedent would suggest that those people would be looking for managerial jobs before that. They might get picked by other clubs, or someone else might come in and you know, start all over again. So I think this is the closest we've been in the last 30 years to having that kind of successful blueprint, that successful model for going forward. The kind of ethos of the club feels very familiar to me. Someone who grew up in the 70s and 80s, very much a philosophy based on what Shankly and Paisley and Fagan preached. And the style of football is very much, you know, reminiscent of Liverpool, and we've got this charismatic figure at the top. So it feels like, you know, all the ingredients are there. But I think what Gary said earlier about all empires eventually crumble, I think the process of that in football has speeded up massively in recent years, and it's difficult to see any team going on doing what Liverpool did in the 70s and 80s, but obviously hope I'm wrong.
I'm sure Gary doesn't, but yeah, I'm all right with it, Jeff. I hope you do. Stephen, you know, for you, I suppose, you know, similar question really, you know, in terms of Klopp, you know, being the right, you know, is he the perfect person for Liverpool right now? Is he the perfect person to lay the foundation for Liverpool Football Club? And I suppose, as Jeff said there, does it feel, because sometimes it's not about results and, you know, and the silverware and the points total and the goal difference. It's more a feeling. You know, does it feel like the club are sort of going in the right direction? Does it feel like the club are back to the Liverpool, or moving towards the Liverpool Football Club that you remember growing up?
Closest resemblance of it, certainly since those days, I think. You know, there was some great times under Benitez, some great times under Houllier. Roy Evans put together a fine footballing side. you know, each of those versions of Liverpool, Brendan Rodgers put together, you know, a version of Liverpool that for me was more akin to, you know, the Leicester that won the league title than the Liverpools of the past, but, you know, still put something quite special together. But it was a something very unique in Liverpool's time, is that I'd define that as a sporadic spike rather than anything that was, you know, built upon or the arc, part of an upward arc or anything like that. You know, Klopp's, I very much believe that Liverpool got to a point where I think only Jurgen Klopp could have won that title for Liverpool. Once Houllier's come reasonably close, and Evans has come reasonably close, and Benitez has come very close, and you know, Rodgers has come to within three games of doing it. Once all that's happened, then, you know, I think Liverpool have definitely got to a point where it would take someone very, very special with a huge, you know, to have the full package to be able to do it tactically, but to have that force of personality. You know, we've had managers that had the tactical know-how, but maybe not the personality to drag it over the line. And, you know, it's having that sheer presence and force of personality as well. If you look at some of the people who won the league title over those years that Liverpool hadn't, you know, Ferguson, you know, a huge personality, a dominant personality in the Old Trafford dressing room, you know, Jose Mourinho, you know, massive personality. You know, there's something egotistical about all of these, you know, personalities, and the same with Klopp. You know, there is an ego at play. You know, he is widely respected and liked by, you know, supporters and watchers of many football clubs. You know, I heard Manchester United supporters that have been benevolent enough to say, "Wish we had him," you know, and all of that. I definitely believe that there was no one likely to be able to do this for Liverpool than Jurgen Klopp. But I think he's opened a door now for other coaches to be able to come into Liverpool and win the league title. I think now that's off the back. But it all comes down to, you know, evolution and staying there and keeping relevant and be able to refresh that team and to keep at the top. As Gary said, you know, all empires and all eras come to an end, and this Liverpool era will eventually come to an end. But, you know, how long it lasts is completely in their hands. But they're not going to dominate it like they dominated previously. You know, there's got to be, you know, Manchester City have such funds behind them that they're going to bite back over and over again. You know, Chelsea won't go long without, you know, before their next title is won. You know, it makes it an interesting landscape, maybe for the Premier League. You know, it's mad to say it, but, you know, four of the last five league titles have been four different teams won the title in the last five in the Premier League, which is very un-Premier League like. And an era where kind of like Bayern Munich are winning the title in Germany every season. You know, what a Juventus on 9 on a row. You know, it's Barcelona or Real Madrid in Spain. You know, suddenly the Premier League is this, you know, bastion of competitiveness. You know, Leicester, you know, won that title, but, you know, City can win it, Chelsea can win it, Arsenal suddenly look like they're on a bit of an upward curve again. You know, Manchester United will not like any of this and be wanting to get in there as well. You know, can Tottenham really kind of like, you know, be kept at bay forever? You know, they have Mourinho now. He's got his big chance to prove that he isn't yesterday's man. So suddenly it gets very interesting. But yes, you know, this Liverpool can remain relevant. I don't think anyone can truly dominate. You know, even if you look at Abramovich's Chelsea and all those years, that, you know, over 15 years now, and I don't think anyone would have guessed back in 2005, 2006, when he was winning those first couple of Premier League titles, that they wouldn't win. You know, they'd go on and win, you know, do a Leon and win 7 in a row, and that never happened. You know, Pep Guardiola's Manchester City, four years of Guardiola now, and he's only, in inverted brackets, you know, won 2 out of the 4, you know, and there's no Premier League, and there's no Champions League to show in that era. You know, it's a very competitive league, but Liverpool have the chance now to stay relevant in it for some years, you know, in certainly for the next 5 or 6 years.
I think there's a really important thing that Steve said there from a Liverpool-centric point of view is you can't really overstate the impact and effect of that 30 years psychologically on players who come to the club and coaches who come to the club, because there's a real kind of, I mean, all the players have spoken about it, you know. You know, the wearing the Liverpool shirt is heavier than wearing another shirt. I think it might have been Brendan Rodgers who said that. Because of the weight of expectation, you want to be that, you know, the ones to end that 30-year wait. And I think winning the Premier League has liberated Liverpool Football Club hugely. And I think Steve's point's very, very well made, that any coach coming into Liverpool now, any player coming into Liverpool now, does not have the burden the predecessors had when they came in. It really has reset the clock. And so maybe, you know, that will play into Liverpool's hands over the next 4, 5, 6 years.
I'm going to ask you a final question here, Gary. I'm not actually sure how you're going to answer this one. Is it, obviously being a Chelsea fan and bearing in mind what the guys have just said, but do you think it's good for the English game that we now have another relevant Liverpool side, to quote the lads? I know you're a Chelsea fan and you would like to win the Premier League and so on, but do you think it's good for English football that Liverpool are now where they are in terms of being a consistent challenger at the highest level?
Can I give you a short answer?
You can take your Chelsea hat off, you can, yeah.
I haven't got my Chelsea hat on, though. I mean, the short answer is yes, because I think Liverpool are a club with a great tradition, and, you know, having a strong champion in any league is important. But the longer answer is, you know, although I agree with what the guys have said, you know, and the season just completed is probably, I mean, you know, I think I'm the oldest of the guys on here, you know, being born in the sort of mid-50s. The Liverpool title win is the most dominant title win in my living memory. You know, and I've seen some great teams, but nothing's come close to a team winning the title by 20-odd points. But if we just sat here at the end of the 1989-90 season, or perhaps even, you know, a couple of years before that, I mean, going back 30-odd years here, could we see the end of Liverpool domination there? This was a magisterial domination. And this, I'm sure the answer is no, we couldn't. And if you could, by God, you know, you ought to take your money out to William Hill very quickly. Because you know a lot about football and predicting the future. But I think the short answer is you couldn't. I'm going to say a couple of things here, which, you know, Steve and Jeff might disagree with, and that's fine. Klopp's got a contract, I think, till 2024.
Yeah.
I don't think he'll be there till 2024. Because I just don't think things happen that way. You know, if he is, I'd be surprised, you know, and you know, because I just think, and Jeff hit the nail on the head a few moments earlier when he said about the period of domination in football in modern times is much more compact. I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, Stevie said that the last 5 Premier League titles have been won by 4 different teams. It's just, again, emphasises the unpredictability of Premier League football. I think Liverpool will probably win the league next season. I'd be surprised if they don't. I'd be surprised if they win it the next 3 or 4 seasons of the bounce. In fact, I'd be amazed, because if football teaches anything, the history of football teaches anything, especially in recent history, is that these things just don't happen, because things change. And, you know, Man City have got loads of brass, and, you know, they're not going to be content with being runners-up for too long. Chelsea laying that stupid money in this transfer window to be competitive again. Man United will not be happy to be also runners to Liverpool. And things change. And there's the old saying about change. You never notice change when you're going through it. You only notice when you look back. You know, life is a death sentence. And I think, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, the guys have sort of picked up on this, you know, I said about all empires crumble and fall eventually. And I think football in the modern era, certainly in the last 15 years or so, has compacted the life of empires very much. And, you know, Liverpool are the dominant team in domestic football, and probably the best team in Europe, and you've got the best team in the solar system, I think I've said before, unless there's a team in the club in Jupiter who could give a decent game, that would be surprising. Not least because the gravity there. But these things do not last for a long time. In English football, they don't last for a long time, and the period of domination Liverpool had in the 80s, I just can't see it being repeated anytime soon. So yes, Liverpool will win the league next season. I'd be surprised if they don't. But I would also be more surprised if they win the next 3 or 4 years, because football just don't work like that.
It's been as it's always wonderful for me. Like I say, I just get to ask questions and then sit back and listen, like everybody else. Who's hopefully sort of a fan of the podcast and a fan of what you guys have to say. I think the Man United fans will be reasonably happy with your answer, Gary, if any are still listening. And they might not be happy that Liverpool are winning the league next season, but I'm going to say they're probably happy at the fact they won't win it the season after. So that's
I said I wouldn't. I just said I'm not convinced.
It's highly unlikely. I apologise. Jeff, as always, we said it right at the start, one of my favourite people to have on, and reason why.
Thanks very much, Stu. Really appreciate it.
It's been an absolute joy to listen to you, and sort of the intricacies and the things about what was, and it's funny because you certainly for me at the time, Liverpool are so dominant that they fall away and you just can't see them winning again, and now within the space of sort of 24 months, these things haven't been forgotten, but by me it's like, oh yeah, Liverpool are back, and it's like the 30 years have almost never happened, I guess. For you Liverpool fans, it really has. But for me, it's just a period of time where somebody else took over and now all is right with the world. It probably just felt a lot longer than 30 years for you too.
Oh, yeah, really has.
Stephen, as always, wonderful. The series is a great concept. It's your idea. It's, it clearly, the idea of the series works really, really well.
Oh, it's going well. It's going well. It's always, I think it's fascinating as well to see kind of like the common theme in how teams fall away. And it's that sense of taking the eye off the longer game, and going back to Manchester United. I don't think they'll be back particularly quickly, Gary. But no, I was going to say no. We need to get someone in to do that one. Actually, that's what we need to be doing. I will massively enjoy that one.
it's funny, isn't it? Because obviously, the last episode was a team that had gone an entire league campaign unbeaten, and yet we're talking about the end of their era. Now we're talking about a side that dominated domestically and on the continent and had multiple seamless changes of manager, and yet again it's the end of an era. And so you have sort of serial trophy winners, you have a side that's good enough to win to go the entire league season unbeaten, and yet here we are talking about the end of eras, if you like. And I think you're right. I think somewhere out there might be a Manchester United fan who's probably now really switched off that might want to come on and just have a discussion about how they feel. It's relatively compared to the duration of Liverpool's and Arsenal's as well, but it will be interesting to see how they see it at potentially an earlier stage of the end of an era, if that makes sense. Gary, brilliant, thank you for being as always a Chelsea fan at times like this when we need to counteract the Liverpool-ness
I'd like to think I was being objective, but I would say that certainly in my lifetime, Liverpool team of the 80s were probably the most dominant team in my living memory of football, and even that Liverpool team didn't win the title by 20 odd points like Klopp's team has now, and perhaps it is the birth of another empire, and who knows. But it's great discussion, and always great to have a chat with you guys. And Jeff has always been great value. We've had him on board for a pod, and lived up to that as well today. So thanks, Jeff. Great to have a chat with you, brother.
Oh no, honestly, love chatting to you guys, and really good mix of Steve's absolutely breathtaking knowledge of the intricacies of the history of the club, which puts me to shame on a regular basis. Gary, with his impartiality and keen observations, and Stu just chairs it all perfectly. So yeah, I love coming on. I'll come on anytime you like. I'll even talk about Man United if you want.
if you
might not want me to, but
I'll tell you what, if we can't find a Man United fan to do that, then we'll do it ourselves and just point and laugh.
I'll book us a 2.5-hour slot on Zoom for that one. All that's left for me to say is once again thanks, guys, and obviously thank you to everyone who's listening. Please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.